The inflation has not been solved. It's going to get worse, and it's going to be catastrophic. The closest analog would be 1929, but worse. The stock market peaked in early September of 1929. It was until 1954 that it matched that price again. We're going to be in a collapse that's worse than that because this collapse is global. The military-industrial complex want wars. The neocons want wars. I have never seen a government as corrupt and as stupid as the United States has been. This is a great time to think about preparing, not only with the preparations that you got, but preparing financially.
Hi folks, Canadian Prepper here, back again with a very special guest. He's a renowned financial analyst, and I'm talking about Bob Moriarty. And he's also a former Marine fighter pilot who flew over 820 missions in Vietnam. He became a captain in the Marines at the age of only 22 and is one of the most highly decorated pilots of that conflict. Now he educates people about the inner workings of the financial system, and he has many books on Amazon. We're hopefully going to talk about everything today, from the current collapse of the financial system, the banking system. We'll talk about history. We'll talk about the conflict. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what does history tell us about what happens next at this point in time we're at with this whole banking system collapse?
Well, here's what's interesting, and you just kind of fell into a trap. It's not a banking system collapse. It's a collapse of the entire financial system. And in simple terms, here's what's happened. When central banks went out 10 or 12 years ago and started giving away money for free at 0% or even negative percent interest in Europe, they created a monster because the value of existing bonds went up. And when people bought those bonds, they were being set up for the rug to be yanked from underneath them, because as interest rates go up, the value of the bonds go down. Now, in theory, government bonds are the safest investment you can make. I'm not saying give you the best reward. I'm saying they're safest. However, when you go from extremely low interest rates to higher interest rates, you tank the price of those bonds. But that doesn't affect just the banks. It affects pension funds. It affects insurance companies. It affects everybody that owns bonds. And it is a global problem. Japan is actually in far worse shape than anybody. Europe's in worse shape than the United States. But let me give you some numbers. In 1922, the UK gilts, highest rated government bonds, went down 53%. The highest rated government bonds in Germany went down 23%. And the highest rated 30-year bonds in the United States went down 29%. And that's just catastrophic for everybody who had bonds. So when the banks started collapsing here a month ago, it wasn't because they had made bad loans. It was because the value of their investments had gone down so much. But it certainly affects insurance companies. Nobody's talking about that. It affects pension funds. And the British recognized last fall that their pension funds were on the verge of collapse. But it's a global problem. It has not been solved. It is going to get worse, and it's going to be catastrophic.
And maybe you can talk a little bit about, are there any parallels in other times in history between what we're experiencing right now?
Absolutely. These things happen all the time. And when I say all the time, I don't mean every year or two. Every 20 or 30 or 50 years, same thing happens. It happened in 1929, and there was too much money, too cheap. There were bad investments made. Everyone was speculating in the stock market, and then the economy collapsed, and it took the stock market with it. Now, to give you an idea, the stock market, the Dow Jones in the United States peaked in early September of 1929. It was until 1954 that it matched that price again. We're going to be in a collapse that's worse than that, because this collapse is global.
So this collapse is going to be worse than 1929, because in 1929 it was primarily the United States who...
It was the United States and Europe.
And so this is a global phenomenon then? Could you maybe explain why it's more global today? Is it just more central banks doing the same thing, or...?
Well, that's part of it. But the world is far smaller today than it was in 1929. In May of 1931, there was a bank in Austria owned by the Rothschilds called the Credit Anschel, and it collapsed, and it caused a series of cascading defaults that eventually led to the U.S. banking system being shut down as soon as Roosevelt was inaugurated in March of 1933. Basically, the system has gotten so far out of whack, it has to be fixed.
And so how does this, what is the next domino to fall? Because it appears, at least on the surface, that the efforts of the FDIC and the Fed have somewhat contained, for at least today anyways, the current banking crisis. What do you think is the next domino that could possibly fall?
That's an impossible question to answer. There's 1,000 black swans flying around overhead, and we know that sooner or later even black swans have to take a crap. And we don't know which one's going to take a crap first. We just know sooner or later we're going to get crapped on. So it could be the banking system, it could be a pension fund, it could be an insurance company. The banking system collapse has only started. Now, 2 weeks ago, last Friday, the Wall Street Journal came out, said, I think the number was there were 156 banks that were in worse shape than SVB. So it's not a small problem. It absolutely has not been contained. It's growing and getting worse. And you can see it from the price of gold today. Gold's up about 36 bucks as we speak. And people are literally looking for safety. And for people, I've been telling people for years, the primary purpose of gold physically in hand as an insurance policy against financial chaos. The financial chaos is here. We're not absolutely certain of what's going to happen or when it's going to happen. We just know it's going to happen.
With this banking crisis, is it just a matter of people not doing a bank run? Like, so long as, just maybe try to help me understand this. So as long as people don't do a bank run, the bank won't collapse, or will the bank, will they be able to have this, to be insolvent and still functional?
Okay, well, you're asking a good question, because historically what happened was bank runs. People got nervous about the money in their bank. They went to the bank, they tried to make a withdrawal, and they couldn't. And I want to point something out that's very important. Banks are in the business of lending long. They borrow short and they lend long. So no matter how well run a bank is, it's always subject to a bank run if there's a financial panic. However, the interesting thing about Silvergate and SVB and the other banks, Signature, it was really the collapse in the value of the bonds that caused them to crater. And the Federal Reserve has done some things that are so foolish and so dangerous. I'm staggered. I think the total amount of money in SVB was something like $17 billion. And there were 10 billionaires who had $13 billion at risk that was not covered by insurance. And the FDIC came in and paid off all the creditors. And that had set a very bad precedent because they've only got 70 cents out of every $100 to be insured. They have 70 cents on hand to insure $100. So any kind of serious bank runs, the FDIC goes broke. So there's so many things going on right now. Russia and China have gotten together. China and Brazil have gotten together. Mexico wants to enter BRICS. Russia and China are trying to take down the dollar as the world's reserve currency, and they're succeeding. And what it means is there's going to be chaos. And I don't think anyone can predict exactly what's going to happen or when. However, I think the value of the dollar is going to go down substantially. If the Fed panics and starts QE again, we're going to go into hyperinflation, and that makes it even worse. So literally, this is a great time to think about preparing, not only with the preparations that you got, but preparing financially.
And what do you think the Fed is going to do now? Are they going to continue to raise rates in light of what's happened with OPEC, with them now reducing the output of oil? Maybe you can talk a little bit about that and how that factors into this whole thing. I'm really interested to know if the Fed continues to raise rates, obviously the problem is going to get worse. So I keep hearing from all these financial analysts that it's either, you know, the Fed raises interest rates and then you have more banks collapsing, or it goes to hyperinflation. And it doesn't appear that there's a way out of this. The debt bubble just has to burst.
Strange enough, that's a very good way of putting it. The Fed has two choices. If they continue to raise interest rates, the value of bonds will continue to deteriorate. If they don't raise interest rates and they go to qualitative easing, then we go into hyperinflation. And it literally is the choice of which is worse, dying of cancer or dying of a heart attack. And at the end of the day, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, that's not a good place to be. So do you think, what do you think this move by OPEC? I know you have the website, I think it's 321energy.com, where you analyze gold and various commodities. So what is your take on what OPEC is doing and how does that factor into all this? And maybe why is Saudi Arabia doing this at this point in time?
Russia invaded Ukraine on the 24th of February last year. And the United States had already prepared sanctions in advance. And as a matter of fact, there was a study done by the Rand Corporation in 2019 that told the DOD exactly how to entice Russia into attacking Ukraine. So the United States put all these sanctions on Russia, believing in error that it was going to hurt Russia, but it wouldn't hurt Europe, and it wouldn't hurt the United States. And in fact, it has destroyed the economy in Europe. Europe went along with it, which is so stupid. I couldn't believe they did it. To give you an idea, I use kerosene in heaters. I've got a little tiny mill. I've got a stream running through the house. And I use kerosene heaters. and the price of kerosene has increased 150% in a year. The price of wood is up 100%. The price of pellets was up 150%. And this is catastrophic for Europe. Why they did this is beyond me, because the economy of Europe was dependent on cheap natural resources from Russia, and the United States didn't want that. So the United States benefits and Europe shuts down. So since it was clearly an attack on Russia, and the United States and the rest of NATO confiscated $300 billion in reserves belonging to the Russians, the Russians are counterattacking. And the Chinese have looked at it and said, if the United States could steal $300 billion from Russia, they could steal from us. So there is a conflict going on. And I think the conflict goes deeper than that. I sent you some information. The very best writer economically on this is a guy named Michael Hudson. And he's just written another book called The Collapse of Antiquity. And the basic thesis is, if you go back to Greek and Roman times, where money was lent at interest, there was always more money owed than existed. So you had two choices. You could have a jubilee every 50 years or so and write off the debts and start all over again, or you could insist on the debts being paid or the collateral turned over. The whole World Economic Forum thing is about turning all of the property over to the Davos crowd. You and I will be useless eaters. We'll rent our clothes. We'll rent our homes. We'll rent everything that we use from the Davos crowd. And what it means basically is we will owe nothing, but we will own nothing and we'll be happy. And certainly your prime minister is a big fan of this. I'm not a big fan of it, because when you own nothing and you owe nothing and you're happy, that's the definition of slavery. Debt is slavery. So the conflict between the United States, NATO, Russia, China is really about the basic economic system. The debt-based system, I believe, is collapsing. And Russia and China are coming up with a new economic system, which hopefully will be better.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people fail to realize that, you know, we have this huge amount of debt that we carry in Western societies, and that's not the case, as far as I know, anyways, for Russia and a lot of these other countries who you call like resource-based economies. Can you talk maybe a little bit more about how debt factors into those economies and why it's so important for the West to defeat Russia and China to maintain that US dollar as the reserve currency? Because if that goes, then, you know, it's game over, right?
Yeah, and that's a good way of describing it. Basically, every country that has a reserve, becomes the world's reserve currency, gets to do that for about 80 or 85 years. It was true of Spain. It was true of the UK. It was true of France. It was true of the Dutch. It was true of the Italians. And it's true of the United States. Now, we became the world's reserve currency in 1944. And what that meant was that Americans had the benefit of having U.S. dollars to spend, where everyone else had to produce to get dollars. So the United States had a free ride since 1944. Nobody wants to talk about that. But as time goes by, the society gets more and more and more corrupt. And you can look at what's happening in the United States, and it's absolutely remarkable. the former president of the United States is in court today being brought up on charges, criminal charges, for the first time in American history. We can't hold an honest election. We can't have a fair trial. Our education system is a total failure. Our medical system is the most expensive in the world. And they want to continue this. And I got to give Russia and China credit. They understand what's happening, and they want to come up with a better solution. And I hope they do.
Yeah, I recall in one of your recent interviews, you said that, you know, Putin is aware of what's happening here in the West, and they're trying to set themselves up to be ready because, you know, with this confiscation of funds or whatever you want to call it, this $300 billion asset seizure, clearly they're better positioned to ride out a global financial implosion, having no debt and having resources, having the ability to produce, you know, like China has all the manufacturing, all the factories, you know, and when the smoke clears, what do we have over here? We have empty Walmarts and empty commercial properties.
And we've the Davos crowd has enriched themselves to a degree that we've never seen in history. We have the biggest dichotomy between the average person's income and the wealth of the Davos crowd in history. And that's how revolutions start. So I'm not sure if we're going to have a revolution. I'm not sure if we're going to have a civil war. I know there's going to be financial chaos. The strange thing is, I don't think there'll be financial chaos in Russia and China because they're prepared. Now, few people remember this, but Putin was part of the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders, okay? So he sat down and he listened to what their plans were, and I think he said, oops, I don't want any part of that whatsoever. Now, we don't know what the Chinese and the Russians are going to do, but everything they've talked about so far is it'll be some kind of resource-based system. And frankly, I believe it'll be centered around gold because that's what everybody's done for 5,000 years.
Yeah, and they've all been buying it, and the Chinese have been divesting from dollars, loading up on gold. And it's just an incredible contrast. It's incredible how we've minimized what's happening in Europe right now. I mean, you have protests in France raging out of control about, you know, them raising the pension age. You have protests in Germany. You're on your third prime minister now in the UK. And you're seeing all this turmoil, and you're seeing the inflation go through the roof. Yet we continue to tell ourselves that we have it better than these guys over here. You know, it's cognitive dissonance at its finest, it seems.
That's a perfect term for it. I wrote a book in 2016. I was in the Marine Corps from 1964 to 1970, and I was in Vietnam from 68 to 70. And I would have written the definitive book about going to war in the 1980s, except I can't spell. I am a terrible, terrible speller. And then, of course, they came along with computers with spell checkers, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven. Now you can't shut me up. I've written about a dozen books. But in 2015, Putin went to the UN, and he was speaking to the United States, and he asked the question, do you know what you have done? And I thought about it, and I thought, you know, that's exactly the question every American should have been asking, and they didn't. So I sat down in 2016, and I wrote a book, 55 Years in Hindsight, of what I thought about Vietnam and my experiences in Vietnam. And at the end of the book, I tried to summarize things of where we were going to go, and I predicted the world's first worldwide revolution, and it would be based around the collapse of the banking system. And it's really simple. When people get more poor every day, they get angry. Are you totally aware of what the issue is in France? Do you understand it?
Well, I think I know it's, and there's probably more to it than this, but I know it's partly related to demographics and aging population and not enough people working, not enough people paying taxes, maybe inflation rates, bloated bureaucracy, I presume, but maybe you can elaborate on some of that.
Now that's a really good way of putting it, okay? What Macron is trying to do, he's trying to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. And since everybody in France is looking at it saying, I've been working for 30 or 40 years and I don't want to have to work for another 2 years, they're angry, okay? And these are some serious verging on revolution kind of protests. These aren't peaceful protests like in Germany. These are really bad protests. And the key is France has worked itself into a corner where there are no good solutions. They either raise taxes and let people retire at 62, or they retire at 64 and leave taxes where they are. But the entire financial system of the West is based around this debt-based economy. And the demographics in Europe are a total disaster. That's true in Japan. It's true in South Korea. And it's certainly true in France and Italy and Germany. They're just not raising enough people to pay taxes in the future. And that's going to create problems. We know that's going to be an issue. We don't know what the solution is, but we know it's a problem.
Yeah, and then compounded on that, they decided to get themselves into a war that has seen, in some cases, like you're talking about, 100% increases in the price of energy. And that was during a warm winter, you know. So just imagine if you have a cold winter next year. And I think next year is the one that they were worried about because, you know, they were able to get through this year with LNG and, you know, maybe economic slowdown, which reduced demand overall. But if demand goes up and, you know, then we're going to see even more. So it's going to be surprising if Macron, you know, is able to get out of this situation alive, much less get reelected.
They're going to have lynch parties all over Europe. I have never seen so many mental midgets running countries as in Europe today. I mean, Europe makes that dingbat running Canada look reasonably intelligent, but we had this very warm, exceptionally warm winter in Europe, and still inflation was above 10%. I've seen reports that food inflation in Germany in the last month was 20%. The inflation has not been solved. It's going to get worse. And here's what nobody's bothered asking themselves. If they ask themselves, is there a shortage of energy, what would the answer be?
Well, maybe they would say, I mean, there's, I guess that's a somewhat contentious issue, but some people would say they're the production has in some ways peaked, but other people would say, no, it's, you know, artificial. What would you say?
100% artificial. This was something didn't happen to happen. Now, Macron went to talk to Biden, and of course, Biden was just as proud as a peacock that he was selling so much LNG from the United States to France. And Macron pointed out, hey, wait a minute, we're paying 4 to 7 times as much money from you as we were from Russia. Yeah. And of course, Biden smiled, took another lick off his ice cream cone, said, yeah, you sure are.
Jeez, yeah, I don't get it. I mean, it's almost like they're, you know, somebody would have to, come to the conclusion that they're under some sort of occupation to have been suckered into that deal, you know.
Of course.
What do you make of the strategic oil reserve nearing, you know, record lows since the 80s? What do you think the plan is there? Because now we're seeing the price of oil go up again. Is Biden going to continue to deplete the strategic oil reserve in order to boost the price, or sorry, lower the price of gas for re-election?
I don't know why you're talking about Biden. Biden doesn't run anything.
That's true.
Biden doesn't make anything. Okay?
Trump said it. Trump made an interesting joke the other day. He said, I don't even know if Biden knows he's alive. And I burst out laughing in a way I don't think I have in a long time when he said that. So, but anyways, you know what I mean, though. What do you think the plan is for the Strategic Oil Reserve?
I don't think there is any plan. I have never seen a government as corrupt and as stupid as the United States has been. And this isn't just the Democrats. I mean, it literally goes back 20 or 30 years. The whole reason the banking system is blowing up now is because the Glass-Steagall Act that was passed in March of 1933 kept investment banking separate from banking. And that was overturned in 1989 under Bill Clinton, and it turned the banks into casinos. So we got this bizarre situation. There is zero leadership in the United States. Nobody knows who's running the country. Basically, it's the FBI and the DOJ, CIA, and the military-industrial complex. And what is good for them is not what is good for the rest of America or the rest of the world. We have someone at the helm. It's like having a 20-year-old dog that's got cancer and a broken leg and can't see and farts all day long. It's cruel to let it continue. And Joe Biden can't walk up a flight of stairs without stumbling. He's got to have a minder on his arm to show him where he's supposed to go. And if you were leader of China, or if you were leader of Russia, or you were leader of Germany, or even Canada, how could you take this guy seriously? And the answer is you couldn't. So this is the leader of the free world who's driving the train on a 45-degree downslope, loaded with nitroglycerin, and he's adding power.
Makes you wonder if they want it like that, you know, if they, you know, whoever they is. But if at the end, you know, if the ship is sinking, you kind of don't want somebody who knows what they're doing, because they might call too much attention to various things. But yeah, it's
I think it goes to the nature of humanity. Gibbons wrote Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and exactly the same thing is happening now. The United States Empire is collapsing. It's clearly collapsing. The rest of the world sees it. Europe's waking up to the fact that they would have had natural gas this year if the United States hadn't committed the biggest act of terrorism in world history against their own allies. That was a civilian target. That wasn't a military target. And the United States took out the Nord Stream 2 so they could sell natural gas at 4 to 7 times the price to Europe. Now, if Europe's stupid enough to fall for it, that's Europe's fault.
Yeah, that's another story altogether. Some of the revelations, or I guess theories of Seymour Hersh, you know, have shed light on that situation. Definitely, you know, implicate the United States in that incident. But what about, you know, hyperinflation? How long does it take if the Fed does go back to quantitative easing? I ask this question to a lot of financial analysts, and I always get mixed results, but how long does it take for us to start to see that realized in the price of everyday goods and services if they go back to it at this point? Like if they switch gears and go into reverse and they start printing money again, how long does it take for the bubble for us to have a crack up boom and for the whole thing to blow?
If you look at the chart of crude oil, the answer is, you know, I think it's up 10 to 15% in the last 2 days. Inflation did not go away. The way they're counting inflation, they've lied about it. And everybody that's been in a food store lately knows the cost of energy is a lot higher. The cost of food is a lot higher. So they can talk about 6% inflation, but that is not what's happening in the real world.
And this is what I don't understand about what Saudi Arabia, our supposed ally, you would think at a time like this, because typically in a recessionary time, you're seeing oil prices go down, but it seems like OPEC is making a conscious effort to keep oil prices elevated, almost to try to collapse the U.S. system, it would seem.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct. Saudi Arabia, and actually, I saw a chart of all of the OPEC countries, including Russia, and it was not just Russia, and it was not just Saudi Arabia. It was everybody. And I think these guys are looking at the United States, and they see this senile old fool right on the edge of a cliff, and they've decided to give him a shove.
Yeah, because it's interesting because Saudi Arabia, obviously, and the USA have military ties. And I guess the assumption there all along was, you know, the Americans would provide the Saudis military cover and they would do their thing. They would get monumentally wealthy and nobody could touch them. But it appears now they've reached a point where they're willing to part ways with that. And it only makes me wonder what sort of situation is going to rise in the Middle East now with Iran and Saudi Arabia shaking hands. And, you know, the writing is on the wall with respect to all of these conflicts.
Yeah, I think it's a good message. Okay, China did what people should do if they're really interested in peace. And boy, I didn't see that coming, okay? The issue between Saudi Arabia and Iran is a religious issue between the Sunnis and the Shiites. It's like Northern Ireland with the Catholics and the Protestants, okay? And you just have to wonder, I mean, what's with this? But there's been a lot of animosity and a little war going on in Yemen with Saudi Arabia providing money and equipment to one side and Iran providing money and equipment to the other side. And China sat down with both of them and said, look, you guys are going to be part of BRICS and we need to get along and there's no reason for you to be in a conflict. The military-industrial complex in the United States want wars. The neocons in the United States want wars. I've been at a war. You don't want war, okay? Literally, war is the very last solution, not the first solution. So China is actually doing what the United States should and could do, is they're providing leadership. And then they go over to Brazil and say, look, you know, why don't we use each other's currencies? We can do more trade. Brazil thought about it, said, good idea. Mexico watched that. And of course, Mexico is our neighbor, just like you are. And Mexico said, hey, we kind of like the way you're doing things. We'd like to join BRICS too. Now, I'm just waiting until Greece or Italy or France or Germany wakes up and says, hey, we'd kind of like to be in your party as well.
How do you think, because I can't see the USA just turning a blind eye to that. How do you think they might try to undermine that relationship between the Saudis and the Iranians?
It's a good question, and I've got to back up. go to my website, and all the pieces I've ever written are still on the website. On March 1st, I wrote that sanctions were going to hurt Europe, hurt the United States, but they weren't going to hurt Russia. Literally, the sanctions were suicide for the EU, for the euro, and for the US dollar. And I absolutely stand by that. And the key is the analogy that I use, and this is true. I was an F-4 pilot from July of 1968 until November of 1968. And then they were going to put me in a ground forward air control slot. And I wasn't real interested in walking around the jungle. So I got myself into an airborne fact job flying bird dogs, and we actually controlled the battlefield. So I go up to Quang Tri, and I'm controlling airstrikes and artillery strikes, naval gunfire strikes. When we would go in and take a hill, we would go in with 10 or 15 helicopters, a couple of planes would get shot down, there would be some people killed. We would land a company or two companies of Marines. They would go out on patrols. More people would get killed. And then 2 weeks later, we'd go pick them up and take them back to base. When you see that happen three or four times in a row with the same hilltop, you realize that you don't have the power that you thought you had. Now, the United States has been living in this make-believe world with all these idiots in Washington talking to each other. And what they're not doing is they're not listening to anybody from the outside, and they're in an echo chamber. The United States is a paper tiger. It doesn't have the power that it thought it had, and everything it's doing is making things worse. Iran is not the enemy of the United States. Iran has never threatened the United States. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. And peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia is a good thing. And frankly, peace in the Middle East would be a good thing. And the United States has supported Israel and allowed Israel to do anything that it wanted to do for 70 years. And that's been the source of most of the conflict in the Middle East. Okay, if you think about Libya, that's a perfect example of how peaceful a solution NATO is. NATO destroyed Libya, and Muammar Gaddafi was doing the best job of running an African country on the continent. His people were better off. There was free education. There was free medical care. When you got married, you were given a house. When you had children, you were given money. He was the best leader in Africa. And if you go to Tripoli now, thanks to NATO, you can buy a slave. We've turned it into an absolute shithole, and there was no purpose to it whatsoever other than the fact that Israel thought that Libya was the enemy. Well, they certainly weren't our enemy. We destroyed them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people will take jabs at him for his eccentricity, but, you know, I think that in many ways, in a developing nation like that, you almost need a leader like that who is going to use some unorthodox methods at times, you know, in order to contain things, because we're viewing it from our lens where we just think we can impose our system on these people. But, you know, you have to kind of evolve into that kind of system. So I think that there will likely be some attempts to undermine the relationship between the Shiites and the Sunnis once again to, you know, keep them fighting with one another. Because like you said, it's all about the military-industrial complex. I still have a few questions about finance before I maybe get your take on this conflict, because obviously being a military man, you have firsthand experience fighting these conflicts, and I'd like to kind of get your take on, you know, what you think is going on in Ukraine. But with respect to, you know, comparing what might be coming, is 2008 a good comparison, or is 1929? Like, what do you think we can expect you know, when people say, well, you know, it's not going to be another 2008, is it going to be just like 2008, maybe a bit worse?
People have a vested interest in understating what they know to be true. There's $300 trillion in debt in the world. It's government debt, it's corporate debt, it's private debt. And everyone that passed Economics 101 in the sixth grade knows that debt cannot be paid. Therefore, you have to do something about it. And nobody wants to address that. 2008 was the very last opportunity for us to allow the banks to pay for their sins. And instead of letting the banks pay for their sins, we evicted millions of Americans who couldn't afford the loans that they had been given, they were talked into giving. The banks were the people. The banks were the bad guys in 2008, and they got bailed out. And there wasn't a single banker that went to jail, and 5 or 6 million Americans lost their homes. And we went from 59% home ownership to under 50%. This is exactly why the debt-based financial system needs to be replaced by something else. So in short order, 2008 was an opportunity, and we didn't take it when we had it. The closest analog would be 1929, but worse.
1929, but worse. So all the more reason to keep on prepping and stacking if it's within anybody's means to do so. So this is kind of going back to that debt jubilee idea. Now, you said in days gone by, civilizations would, they'd have a debt jubilee where they'd wipe the debt out every few decades or so. But today, right, what we're doing is we're bailing in and we're putting the all-powerful leaders are taking everything for themselves. Is that, could you maybe elaborate a bit on that?
The question is, do you want the 1% to have all the power and all the money, or do you want the 99% to have the power and the money? And I'm going to point something out that I don't think anybody, including Michael Hudson, has pointed out. Every society has rich, and every society has poor. And no matter what you do, there are always going to be poor people, and there are always going to be rich people. But the stability of a society is based around the number of people in the middle class. And the bigger the middle class, the more stable the society. So rather than worrying about the poor, which is what we pretended to do for the last 60 years, and rather than catering to the wealthy, which we've done for the last 60 years, what we really need to do is we need to look out for what is best, what is good for the middle class. How do we build a comfortable, wealthy, stable middle class? The middle class in Europe, frankly, is being absolutely destroyed, and it's suicide. They did it to themselves. So I would highly suggest people read Michael Hudson. I think the guy is absolutely brilliant, and he breaks it down into this issue of you can either hand all of the power to the 1%, or you could spread the power out to the 99%. And frankly, I believe handing the power out to the 99% is much better. Since COVID hit, three quarters of the increase in wealth has gone to the 1%, and the money going to the 99% has gone down. The last time Americans had a raise was 1980, okay? It's been 43 years incomes have been going downhill, and that's not a healthy thing.
And the real rub is that you know, they were handing out all these stimulus checks and everybody thought they were going to get rich, and all the retail investors poured into the markets in 2020 and blew up the bubble, and then they got wiped out, and there's still probably a long way to fall yet.
Yes, exactly right.
It's incredible how that whole racket works, where the stimulus only benefits the people who need the money. You know, in the moment, it seems like a good thing, but in the end, all that money just makes its way back into the hands of the people who own all the corporations and stuff, right?
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the World Economic Forum is trying to do.
Yeah. What about your predictions on stock valuations? I mean, we know that based on the Shiller P ratio, we're sitting at the same level as we were in 1929. Now, a lot of people change the metric. They say, well, you got to look at it from post 2000, and by that metric, we're not too far from the mean. But you often talk about this regression to the mean, and you know, what is your, like, and I know a lot of people don't want to give, you know, clear quantitative predictions, but what would you say we could potentially see in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or the major indices in the next couple of years, I guess?
Yeah, that becomes a really hard thing to predict, because you don't know if a tightening is going to continue or quantitative easing, and you either go into much higher interest rates or you go into hyperinflation. And here's the key. The stock market can go up in apparent terms and down in nominal terms, okay? Yeah. If the price of gold goes up tenfold and the price of the Dow goes up twofold, has the Dow gone up? And the answer is obviously not. Now, if you go back to the German hyperinflation in 1922 and 1923, yes, the stock market went up, but in nominal terms, it didn't go up. It actually went down. My belief is that everything that was pumped up by the free money, which would include the bond market, the stock market, that I believe that it will go down in real terms and nominal terms. However, hyperinflation is a very real threat. However, the Dow and the S&P can double and still go down at the same time. That's a hard thing to grasp, but it's true. If there is a nuclear conflict, we will be the ones to do it. And we will lose, and it would result in the destruction of the United States and probably of the world.
The best way to support this channel is to support yourself by gearing up at CanadianPreparedness.com, where you'll find high-quality survival gear at the best prices, no junk, and no gimmicks. Use discount code PREPPINGGEAR for 10% off. Don't forget, the strong survive, but the prepared thrive. Stay safe.